This morning is from Mark. Mark 10, verses 1 to 12. Is that right? Everybody ready? On page 1076. And can we read alternately? And I'll start. And he left there and went to the region of Judea and beyond the Jordan, and crowds gathered to him again. And again, as was his custom, he taught them. And he answered them, "What does Moses command you?" And Jesus said to them, "Because of your hardness of heart, he wrote you this commandment." Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate. And he said to them, "Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. May our minds not wander so God can speak to us through his word this morning."
I begin by acknowledging that our text this morning from Mark chapter 10 addresses that which is not just controversial, but that which is of the experience of many a painful experience. John Piper writes, "Few things are more painful than divorce. It cuts to the depths of personhood unlike any other relational gash. It is emotionally more heart-wrenching than the death of a spouse. Death is usually a clean pain. Divorce is an unclean pain. In other words, the loss of a spouse in death is compounded in divorce by the ugliness of sin and moral outrage at being so wronged." End of quotation. So for many who have experienced or have been impacted by divorce, it may bring back, that mention of the word may simply bring back memories that hurt and strong emotions, feelings of grief, disappointment, regret, failure, guilt, betrayal, anger. In the first century when Jesus walked this earth, divorce was no less controversial. It was no less painful. Verse 2 of chapter 10 reveals that some Pharisees came up and put this question to Jesus. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? They're not sincere in their asking the question. They're not really interested in what Jesus really has to say. You notice there it says that they came up and asked them this in order to test him. And the word test there means to try to entrap or to try to cause to stumble. Jesus uses the same word again later in Mark chapter 12 when he is talking with the Pharisees and the Herodians, who again try to trap him on the question of whether people should pay taxes or not. And knowing their intent, knowing that they come with hypocrisy, knowing that they come to try to trip him up, Jesus says to them, using the same word here in Mark 10, "Why do you put me to the test?" Among the Jews of Jesus' day, there was general agreement that divorce and remarriage was lawful. It was based, this opinion, this understanding of their in their minds was based upon Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 1 to 4, and it reads as this. Deuteronomy 24, verse 1, "When a man takes a wife and marries her, if then she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, and she departs out of his house, and if she goes and becomes another man's wife, and if the later man hates her and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter man dies who took her to be his wife, then her former husband who sent her away may not take her again to be his wife after she has been defiled, for that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring this sin upon the land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance." Now, from this text that Moses gave the nation, we notice that from that time and all through the Old Testament and even up into the first century, for a Jewish couple, divorce was mainly and only the prerogative of the husband. Only the husband could write that certificate. And he made the decision whether or not he shall remain married to his wife. The wife didn't have the authority or the choice to divorce her husband. The man himself made that decision, and that without any legal court. He just decides, "I'm not going to stay married to you," writes a certificate, gives it to her. The controversy in Jesus' day then was not about whether or not the Jewish husband had the right to divorce his wife. Most people in that day understood that, yeah, the man had the right. The controversy in Jesus' day arose on what grounds could the husband divorce his wife? For what reason could he send her away? Verse 2 of Deuteronomy 24 referred to some indecency that the man had found. It's likely that this indecency is not adultery. When you read the law, adultery was punished by death, not by divorce. So there's some indecency that he found, that he did not like his wife anymore. We don't know what those words mean. The meaning is lost to us. We are unsure. The word is used once elsewhere in the Old Testament, and it refers to human excrement. So we really do not know. So you can see then divorce, as they come to Jesus with this question, is more than a suitable topic in terms of having controversy, because there is all different kinds of definitions and understandings of what grounds served as a reason for a Jewish man to divorce his wife and what that indecency was. Well, Jesus responds then, as you see in Mark chapter 10, with a question of his own. The question is, well, what did Moses command you? And the Pharisees then paraphrase Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 1 to 4. Their paraphrase is, well, Moses allowed a man to write a certificate and send his wife away. And this response shows or reveals to us that the men or the Pharisees questioning Jesus have an assumption. Their belief is that, well, Moses allowed it. So the husband has the right to dissolve the marriage if he so chooses, as long as he gives that certificate of divorce. Moses allowed it. It's okay. It's all right. Jesus begins to take a different view. Verse 5, Jesus said, because of your hardness of heart, he wrote you this commandment. So we must note clearly from this verse, from Jesus' response, he's saying, where did this command come from? Where did this permission of Moses come from? Well, it has its grounds or its origin, its roots in the hardness of the man's heart. Why did Moses write this permission? Because your hearts, guys, were hard, disobedient, sinful. And the emphasis of Deuteronomy 24, we must note, is not about establishing the grounds for divorce or the reasons for divorce. That's not what Deuteronomy 24 is about at all. Deuteronomy 24 is addressing the post-divorce relationship of the husband and wife. It's giving rules for how they shall relate after the divorce. It's not talking about rules and reasons in which a couple may divorce. So we see, in particular, that it stops the man from remarrying his wife after she has remarried someone else. And it also protects the wife or the woman because she has to be given a certificate where the husband is saying, she's no longer my wife, I have no claim on her. Therefore, she is free to remarry. And this protects her in a number of ways. One, it protects her legally from the husband keeping her in a state of abandonment. He can't say, no, she's my wife, and then not provide for her and not allow any other male provide for her, but keep her in a position of poverty. It also protects her from the husband charging her with adultery when she remarries. And it also keeps the first husband from interfering in that second marriage. We have to remember that most women in those days through the Old Testament were not in a position to be economically or socially independent. Therefore, remarriage was basically a given unless they wanted to spend the rest of their life in some form of poverty, slavery, or prostitution. So this legislation of Deuteronomy 24 stopped the man from keeping her in a nasty situation of social and economic abandonment or poverty by making him renounce all claims. But the key point then from Jesus' answer to the Pharisees' reference of Deuteronomy 24 is that divorce originates not in the will of God, but it originates in the men's hard hearts. It originates in sin. As divorce was taking place in defiance of God's will, God's original design of marriage, the commands of Deuteronomy 24 arose to manage the consequences of the actions of the men's hard heart and to manage their behavior after the divorce. R.T. France helpfully comments at this point, and I quote, was the provision of Deuteronomy 24, 1-4 then a mistake? That does not follow from Jesus' argument. It was rather a mark of divine condescension. Even after his people had rejected his design for marriage, God gave them laws to enable them to make the best of a bad job. But the Mosaic permission was not a statement of the way God intended things to be. For that, one needs to look in Genesis at the way God had set up his pattern for human sexuality from the beginning before the fall. So the mistake in relation to Deuteronomy 24 is not that of Moses in making legislative provision for the problems which arise in a fallen world after divorce has taken place, but that of his interpreters. And by that he means the Pharisees and the Jewish men, who have taken this regrettable but necessary provision as the starting point for their ethical discussion in preference to the original purpose of God as expressed in Genesis. But if the latter, Genesis, is allowed to its proper status, Jesus' pronouncement still stands. What God has united must not be divided. End of quote. So in other words, what Francis is saying is that the Pharisees and the Jewish men, as they approach this question, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? He's saying they're starting at the wrong place. They got it backwards. They're starting with the laws that were given to manage the post-divorce relationship. And that's not the place to start when you want to answer the question, is it lawful for a person to divorce? Because if you start with those laws that address the post-divorce relationship as they did, they will then assume as they did, divorce is lawful. They are starting in the wrong place. If they want the real answer to that question, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife, they have to start with Genesis. They need to start with another text, not Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy does not answer this question. So this is where then Jesus goes, as we see in Mark chapter 10, verses 6 to 8. He goes back to the beginning of creation and the establishment of marriage prior to the fall or the entry of sin into the human race. And this is what he says in verses 6 through 8. But from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh, so they are no longer two, but one flesh. Jesus is specifically referring to Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, and Genesis chapter 2, verse 24. If you want to turn to Genesis 1, and look at verses 26 to 28, and then Genesis 2, 15 to 25. I'm going to bring out two of the points from those passages that Jesus is quoting from that he is making here. And you can just kind of follow along as I reference different verses. The first point that Jesus is making here by referring back to Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 is marriage has its foundation in God's creative design of humanity being male and female. In other words, if God had not designed the human race as male and female, there likely would not even be marriage. It wouldn't even exist. But because God created us humans as male and female, that's the foundation which leads to marriage. So when you look at Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 to 28, you see that just prior to that, you see that God had made the universe, he made the earth and everything in it, and then he is filling the earth with all different types of living creatures and living things, and then he decides he's going to make something he has not yet made that is very different and very unique. He's going to make a creature that has his own image, that's made in his image. And then he's going to give this creature made in his image dominion, rule over everything else that he has made. And then he's going to give this creature made in his image the ability to reproduce and command that creature to fill the earth. What is that creature? As you know, that creature is man or humanity. And he made man or humanity in two modes. We only exist in two modes, male and female. That's it. And then we move on to Genesis 2, 15 to 25, which gives a more detailed account of that creation. And we see then that the first being, human being made in his image, was the male, and he had put him in a garden that he called Eden to work it. But in that situation, God states in Genesis 2:18 that it's not good for the male to be alone. So he will create a helper, a suitable helper for the male. Suitable meaning equal and adequate. That is, he is going to make a helper of the same type, same level. So it's not going to be like the animals who are beneath, lower, and it won't be like God in the sense of deity, because that's higher, on the same level, a helper that's suitable, that can relate. And then it is a helper, a word that describes someone who comes through the aid or service of another. And so God, being the first and greatest anesthesiologist, puts the man to sleep, performs a little surgery with a rib, and then makes and creates out of that rib his suitable helper. And it is important to note that that helper has the full image of God as well. And though she is different, it is a she, not a he. He didn't make another man. He made a female, not a male. And in her difference, she will provide what he lacks. So that as the two of them, both being different, come together, they shall be complete and remedy what is not good, the male being alone. So just from the design of the human race, marriage finds its foundation in being men and women being created male and female. So that leads us to, secondly, God's creative design leads to the joining of the male and female as one flesh in marriage. So God brings the female to the man in Genesis 2:22. And verse 25 describes it as what? That union, that joining as marriage. Notice it says, "And the man and his wife were both naked and not ashamed." So when God brought them together, he performed the first wedding, performed the first official marriage. He did that work and brought them together. And as they were created this way, verse 24 of Genesis 2 sums up that since humans are created male and female, with their unique differences, which are simultaneously complementary, providing that which the other sex lacks, that design is going to perpetually, continually drive the two sexes together. It will cause the male and the female to leave, to separate from their closest and most vital union that they know, their parents. Their parents. It takes an incredible drive to cause us to separate from our parents and join a stranger of the opposite sex, and to want that. This is how God made us. So that we, having this drive for marital union with a member of the opposite sex, it causes us to create a new union separate from our parents, and that a union that surpasses allegiance to our parents. So when brought together in marriage, the male and female find a unity, a wholeness, becoming one flesh, where together they are equipped to fulfill God's command to rule or have dominion over the earth and to fill and populate the earth. So they can't do it alone, but they can do it together. So from this intent and this design of creation, Jesus then goes and states his conclusion in verse 9 of Mark chapter 10. "What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate." Now, it's imperative we understand two things here. First of all, we need to understand that it is God who is joining the male and the female together in marriage. It is God who's making the single male and the single female husband and wife. I have the authority from the Ontario provincial government. I have the right, the legal ability, the license to solemnize the desire of a male and a female to come together. And I have the authority, to pronounce them husband and wife. I have the authority to pronounce the change in their status from a single male and a single female to being one, to be married, to be in marital union. But I am fully conscious every time I do that, it's really not me doing it. It's God. And I am merely representing Him. And I am merely making tangible and visible what God is doing in His own work of bringing that male and female together and His own joining them together. It's not me, it's not the couple, it's not the government that really makes that change in status. We did not make marriage. We did not design it. We did not think it up. God did, as we've just saw from Genesis. And it's He who is at every marriage between a man and a woman, bringing them together, creating them as one. Therefore, second, since it is God who's bringing them together, we must recognize since God brings them together, humans do not have the right to break that. We do not have the right to divorce. The Pharisees' question was, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? The Pharisees' affirmation was, yeah, the man had a right to put away his wife as long as he sends her away with a divorce certificate. Notice the emphasis on the man. Yes, the man, Moses gave the man, the husband, a permission to send her away. Well, what Jesus is doing here is He is removing the man, and also, as we read verse 12, He removes the woman, both of them, from the position of determining when a marriage shall end. He says, that's not your prerogative. That's God's prerogative. And He reasserts God as the Lord of marriage. So He says, what God has brought together, let no man separate. Marriage being something that God has designed and something that God solemnizes Himself, something that God is at work, then for a human to break that, it is A, unnatural, because this is God's creative design, and B, it's rebellion, because it is usurping God's authority. So David Garland sums it up well. I quote, "Since God is the one who joins the two together, He is the Lord of the union. Who are males to make themselves the lords of the marriage by ousting an unwanted wife?" The answer to the Pharisees' question is therefore no. It is not lawful for a husband to put away a wife. If one understands lawful in terms of God's will and not in terms of finding escape clauses in the legal fine print. End of quote. So let's summarize. The Pharisees came to Jesus seeking to trap Him. They asked the question, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? They believed that it was lawful because of their understanding of and their starting place of Deuteronomy 24. Jesus points out that Deuteronomy 24 really only came about to regulate the hard hearts of the Jewish men, the sin that they had committed in their marriages. And therefore, that is not the right text. That text doesn't answer the question. Instead, you have to look at Genesis 1 and 2. And there we find God's creative intent and God's design for marriage. And we find that God is at work. And He is joining the male and the female together, putting them in a union where they become one, so that they then together may fulfill His command of populating the earth and ruling over the earth. And that is His design. So as God brings the couple together in marriage, humans do not have the right to break that union. Divorce is unlawful. Time to wrap up. Yet, there are many more questions. We have not examined verses 10 and 11, which Jesus says some rather astounding things. He says, Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her, and same with the wife. We haven't looked at that. And then some of you, no doubt, are thinking, well, what about the parallel account in Matthew 19, verse 9, where Jesus says, I tell you that if anyone divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another, they commit adultery. What about that exception? How are we to understand that? And what about some of the practical issues? Can God forgive me and my divorce? Oh, the answer is yes, most assuredly, yes. We'll look at that next time. And what about remarriage? Another practical question. These issues we will touch on in part two of this message on October 29th. Next week is the anniversary Sunday, and Mark Hartnett will be speaking, so I will continue looking at the scriptures and what else has to be said on the 29th. But to close, here are two thoughts for us to digest until then. I know that there are quite a number of divorced and remarried divorcees in our congregation. For some of you, your divorce was a long time ago. For some of you, it's still fresh. Though you may have sinned in this way or been sinned against in this way because you were divorced against your will, it was forced on you, my intention is not at all to beat you up with God's teaching. My intention is to speak it clearly, yes, but not to beat you up. You've already been beaten up by yourself enough, by your family members, your own conscience. And some of you, you're still bearing the consequences of your divorce and will for the rest of your life. But you have worked it through with God after confession and repentance. You've received forgiveness and redemption, and you've been able to move on. But the application I want to give does not just apply to you, it applies to every one of us. The application is for all of us, including those of us who have not divorced. You see, the first application is that every one of us, even if we're single, must fight the hard heart. You see, divorce really is a symptom and a result of something else that come much, much earlier, a hard heart. And so in every marriage, every husband, every wife has to fight this. I have to fight this in myself. Because a disobedient, hard heart to God that rejects His creative design and commands for marriage does not start at the point of divorce. It starts years earlier in the marriage. And therefore, every one of us needs to be ruthless with our hard hearts. It appears much earlier in the marriage when a spouse begins to hold grudges. It appears earlier when a spouse puts their own interests and happiness first. The hard heart appears way earlier when a spouse refuses to admit they're wrong and say they're sorry to their spouse. The hard heart comes out when we're rude and selfish and disrespectful and lazy. And then a hard heart does not show up just in a couple who has divorced. It's evident in the marriages of the couples who stay together, but whose marriages have long been cold and cruel to each other. And though they may never divorce, their hearts are hard. They're just keeping the appearance of the law, but not the spirit of the law. So we all must be on guard, because divorce originates in a hard heart, as Jesus said, and we all have those. We all have to fight those. If we're going to obey the commands of Christ to fulfill His design for marriage and command for marriage as He wants, then we all have to work really hard in defeating the hard heart. And then secondly, we all need to uphold, proclaim, and live the high standards of marriage as God designed and commands, simultaneously explaining divorces against God's will. We need to uphold both. Even with the high number of people in North America, even with the high number of Christians who have divorced, the solution is not to look at all the failures and to look at all the bad examples and then give up and set aside God's standard, making divorce acceptable, or dismissing marriage altogether, replacing it with cohabitation. That's not the way forward. That's not the way to address the divorce crisis of North America and Christianity today. To give up, lower the standard, just because many have failed? No. 10 people make raspberry peach turnovers. 8 of the 10 utterly fail in making their raspberry peach turnover. Some burn them to a crisp. Others have such the wrong ratio of dough and fruit. So one has mostly dough and any little bit of fruit. And another one has way too much fruit and no dough. And another one mixed up and got salt instead of sugar. So 8 of the 10 failed in making their raspberry peach turnover. Nobody reasons this way. Well, most failed, so we're going to conclude that the poorly made turnovers will become the new norm. And we shall just make burned and salty and poor ratio fruit dough ratio turnovers. Nobody reasons like that. What do? We go back to the original recipe and we try again. So why do we apply the same faulty logic to our relationships and marriages and divorce? Why do we say, well, there's just so many failures, we just might as well give up and we'll reject marriage as God has defined it, a lifelong commitment of love between one male and one female till death? The solution is not to reject God's standard and say, well, we've just failed too much, we'll accept failures as the new standard. No. Rather, the solution is in humility and repentance, return to God's creative design and intent that Jesus declares is still the standard, even in a sinful world. And we make that standard our aim. We proclaim it. We commit ourselves to it. Then as disciples of Christ, who denying ourselves and having received the rule of God like a little child, we fulfill our marriage vows with God's grace and God's strength as He intended. And only a return to God's design for marriage and a rejection of divorce by us in our generation will bring hope and blessing for future generations, sparing them to repeat the horrible pain and havoc our hard hearts have led us to in this generation. May the Lord give us much grace and strength. I ask the music team to come forward.